Hi, and welcome to Upthink. I'm Lawrence Akers. I'm a clinical hypnotherapist, member of the LGBTQI community, and a passionate advocate for mental health. These podcasts have been made in the hope of sharing insight into issues that impact on the LGBTQI community. Today, we're talking with Magnus Dean, a fabulous Australian DJ, as well as an advocate for discussion and exploration of mental health. Magnus has recently run a fundraiser titled Peace, Love and Tunes, with proceeds going to Black Dog Institute. Magnus, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, first question, what prompted you to become an advocate in mental health for the gay community?
I suppose for me personally, you know, I've suffered my own and struggled with my own journey. Not a lot, I suppose, compared to other people, but still it was something that I found just in the last few years of my own struggle that I was finding that other people are also going through the same sort of, you know, grief, loss, struggles, you know, with finances, drugs, alcohol, whatever different triggers and connections they weren't making themselves. So I wanted to then share my story to help others, you know, to think that, you know, you're not the only person that's going through such a struggle on your own. Yeah.
And you fantastically did it via some of the street press that was out there. What had been the reaction from people when you did that? Were people surprised to see you do that, or did they know? What reaction did you get?
I suppose a bit of both. Not many people knew, and also the people that did know, I got a lot of unexpected, you know, that's such a strength and we're so proud of you. That must have been hard. And actually, it wasn't hard to come out and talk about it, you know. I've never really had an issue personally talking about anything. You know, I actually say to my friends, if you know, if you want to ask me a personal question, sure, you can ask me anything you like. You know, I don't really have any secrets. So talking about it for me wasn't difficult. The reaction that I got to it was honestly overwhelming, surprising, really comforting to know that people were out there thanking me for sharing my story when they'd gone through a very similar journey in their own life. It was touching, you know, and I didn't do it for me, but it was for the people that, you know, that came out and said, thank you, you've really helped us just by talking about it. And that's, I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah. How long have you personally experienced issues with anxiety or stress or depression?
It's probably been only in the last 4 to 5 years. So, you know, it's more recent than not. Different reasons, I suppose, you know, triggers, my mental health, yeah, has always been good, but when you go through personal situations where maybe you're down and out between jobs, relationship breakups, you know, there's all sorts of reasons that can impact on that. And sometimes you just don't know where or why the anxiety hits, or, you know, you're in a really bad and a deep, dark place. It's something, yeah, which just sort of almost catches you unaware. And it's something which I've been fortunate enough to have my own strength to get through it and know that, you know, I'm not in a good place, and through my own positive, I suppose, actions and, you know, with a bit of support from family and friends and some counselling, I've been able to, you know, sort of claw my way back out, but I still have my bad days. I'm not out of the woods, so to speak. I'm better than I was, because I have got, I think, more support around me by also coming out with my story, so that's helped me in a way, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You're talking about still having your bad days there. Like, I think for a lot of people, when they do have the bad days, they sometimes feel that it's something that they fight because they feel it's something they shouldn't be experiencing. Is that something you still do now? Do you think you greet those bad days with a little more acceptance and a little more self-compassion?
Yes and no. it depends on the day. Like, I used to try and fight it and I found that just didn't work. And I've tried different things to see based on the triggers and because it just comes out of nowhere where and what I should do. So, example, you know, if I can get myself out of the house, I'll go for a walk, put my headphones on. And obviously, you know, being a DJ, music is like my driving force. It pretty much is the only constant that will get me through and get me out of that. But sometimes, yeah, I just have to learn to, when I'm having one of those days, is to just ride it, you know, let the emotions and not fight it so much because it can be overwhelming. I create more anxiousness or anxiety when I'm having that feeling. Yep. So it builds. So I've learned to go, you know what, I've just got to go breathe, you know, go for a walk. I said, put some music on or do something that's going to deflect that or channel into something, you know, more positive and more motivational and more, yeah, uplifting, I suppose. Yeah, yeah.
What sort of things have you done to educate yourself around, you know, what anxiety actually is?
Excuse me. Not a lot of education, but I've read a lot of things. Just talking to my counsellor on a weekly basis, who I have seen for the last 4 or 5 months. She's really helped just identify, going back to even when I was a young child, the certain aspects of my personality that, excuse me, that trigger some of these anxieties and these depression points. So even just talking about some of those things, which is bringing up quite a bit of painful memories from my childhood, is actually helping me identify maybe some of the triggers that are causing those things now, which are a lot more deep set than just maybe what I'm going through currently in life. So if that makes sense. Yeah. So I quite often, you know, reading articles and just talking to other people, you know, I think information is education, obviously. And therefore just talking to people helps me understand it a bit more as well as them.
It's funny you say that because, you know, quite often I'll have some clients that come in and they'll present with a certain issue and they'll be convinced that it's nothing that's particularly deep rooted. Is, you know, the phrase I think I hear often. Oh, it's not a deep-rooted problem. I just want to change this. But then the more exploration we do, the more it starts to go back to these childhood beliefs. Recently, I had a client who was talking about his particular presenting issue and then freeform just suddenly speaking back about a time when he was 10 or 11. And it wasn't until I kind of stopped that conversation and said, have you noticed how you've just regressed back to this time that it became a little bit more present to him. What kind of things do you think happened in your own childhood that formed these kind of beliefs to happen?
Being an only child, for me, as a child, was not difficult, but, you know, I suppose learning to appreciate your own time and your own self was always a challenge. You know, I would have always liked to have had an older brother or sister. Now I do have, you know, extended family, which is great. But there was times when I was lonely. You know, I won't deny that. I had, you know, plenty of friends at school. But even with my mum and dad splitting up from a really early age, you know, I was expected to be the father of the house and, you know, that sort of role, which, you know, when you're thrown into that at an age when you're not equipped to be a father or, you know, to be the man of the house was challenging in itself. And then I suppose just with some issues that my mum still hasn't dealt with has sort of flowed onto me. So I had a very functional upbringing. Right. I'm not saying my mum never loved me. However, and these are some of the things I'm talking about with my counsellor back then to help me with my life now. I wasn't shown a lot of love from my mum. So that's also impacted on my relationships that I've had in life, not so much my friendships, but my relationships. So we've identified that the functionality at the time I was, you know, growing up with mum, then as a teenager also then made me have a sort of a reckless Magnus, we've identified, which is a little kid in the back seat. Yep. And he likes to sabotage me, and he still does. He doesn't get me off the rails as bad as he used to sometimes, but he actually is the person rebelling against the functional upbringing I had. So every now and again, yeah, it's great to, you know, go off the rails and, you know, and you know, screw life, so to speak, you know, and have some fun. But at the end of the day, I used to let him sort of run or drive the car a lot more than I should be. So I'm in the driver's seat. This is my life, not his. But we've identified that we need to, this is my counsellor, that we need to help them work together because they're the same person, obviously, it's me. And then that way we can help each other and work out how to stay on the road, but also then if I want to have some fun, then just make sure it's, you know, it's not too out of control, if that makes sense. Mm. I don't know. I've gone off a bit track there.
it's fun. I love that whole idea of this reckless Magnus that's another part of you. That sits there and you know, tries to take over and control. What kind of things does the reckless Magnus tell you to have you believe about yourself?
He wants to have fun. That's all it is. I think because I was denied so much as a child, not denied, but, you know, it was very functional. It was almost like army-like upbringing. So if I wanted to do something, my mum said no. So as a teenager, you rebel anyhow. So it was almost like a, you know what, I want to have some fun. So I would do things maybe like sneak out at night, and I found, you know, some of my first gay clubs here in Melbourne by getting on the last tram down in St Kilda and, you know, ending up at Mandate when I was 17. Yeah, I was still underage. I was still at high school, still living at home. But, you know, that's the sort of thing I was wanting to do. I was coming to terms with my sexuality at the time, obviously, you know. No one at school knew, so I was not Not that wasn't an issue, but you know, I was finding myself, you know, and I found a gay club. I said, you know, down in St Kilda called Mandate, and I was like, and that was when I think, I suppose, that added to my love for music, you know, and other gay men, and a place where I could feel comfortable, you know. So I've always enjoyed the music, you know, all through my life, and I've also enjoyed being around people, because I think also, you know, I had that sort of rigid upbringing where it was just me. So it was almost like, oh, thank God, you know, I can be out, I can have music around me, and I can, you know, be dancing, other men, you know, and just socializing. I think because I just didn't have that much as a child. So it was almost like, thank God I'm free, you know.
Why do you, and I think this is a really great point as well. Why do you think, dance music has played such a part in gay men's lives?
I suppose we, no, I'm in my 40s, so we all grew up, you know, most of us in this generation grew up in the 80s and the 90s, and I don't know about you, but for me, music was always part of my life. You know, my dad has the most amazing vinyl collection, and I grew up listening to artists like, you know, Bob Dylan, The Beatles, Pink Floyd, mm-hmm. Creedence, and I still love all that rock music. But then, yeah, going through high school and then growing up and listening to, you know, Stock Aitken and Waterman came out, and then yeah. There was Donna Summer, and, of course, you know, there's the Madonna and the Pet Shop Boys, you know, Barbara Streisand, Bette Midler, and all those typical sort of, you know, stereotypical acts or, you know, musical artists. But for me, I think it just brings people together, and it doesn't have to necessarily be dance music. But I think with, you know, the gay scene, we get it. You know, I think you ask anyone, if you go to a straight club or a gay club, which clubs play the best music? You know, it is the gay clubs. I'm sorry, but, you know, we get music. I think that's because we can go to a place and find a common ground, as in, you know, good music, good company, you know, dance the night away, whether you're on alcohol or drugs, that's not the point. But I think we can forget what's going on in the real world, you know, whether it's today or whether it's 20 years ago, and just connect with music. And I think that's the beauty I get out of it when I go and play at a gig. I can see people on the dance floor of different age, different race, different sexuality, different skin colour, different political beliefs, different religion. You know what? They're all dancing to the one beat. Doesn't matter where they're from and who they are, but everyone's connected. And I think that's what I love. That's what I love seeing here.
I had someone ask me recently why it is that gay men are so attracted to pop acts like Kylie Minogue. And to me, I felt it was because of the fact that, especially in Kylie's early days, there was a certain almost, dare I say, tragicness, you know, a naivety and innocence about her that, you know, made her feel not really that credible as an artist. But then when she kind of discovered who she was, there was this blossoming or a coming out into being this incredible female artist. And I think that a lot of gay men recognize that similarity between, you know, us being these innocent, naive, pre-coming out, scared of what the future has to hold, until we come out and discover, you know, that we could be equally as powerful or sexual or, you know, in charge of who we are. That wasn't really a question.
No, it wasn't,
that
was
a statement, wasn't it?
Thanks for that.
Are there any acts that you feel hold that special meaning for you that reflect who you are as a person that as you came out, you held very dear to?
Well, there's two. I mean, you know, and they might be very cliched for me and the gay community, but, you know, Madonna and Pet Shop Boys for me, you know, I listened to them. I loved them growing up in the 80s, and their songs, you know, even now listening to the songs from 30 years ago, still resonate with, you know, how I was coming to terms with my sexuality and how music was evolving in the 80s. And look, you know, those two artists for me have been a driving force, you know, and both of them obviously are very strong advocates for the gay and lesbian community. They've done a lot for heaping people coming out, you know. Even when Pet Shop Boys were very early in their first years, I didn't know they were gay. You know, it wasn't an issue, but knowing that they are, has sort of added to that whole journey of their music. You know, they've had a whole different, you know, set of albums over the years. Same with Madonna. But those songs, you know, you ask anyone, any song from either of those artists, and you can pick a song that will take you back to a certain time in your life that has memories, whether it's, you know, with a friendship, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a place, whether it's a club. You can connect to that song. You can relate to the words. I think there's a personal journey in both those artists' songs to help people deal with the now and even the then. When I was listening to that music, it was almost cathartic for me. You know, it was like I had a place where I could relate to, connect to, and feel that I wasn't the only one on my own journey. Yeah, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I think Pet Shop Boys, a lot like George Michael, before coming out, their music had clear indications as to who they were. You know, I think it's really hard not to listen to something like It's a Sin and not really recognize what that song is actually about. And the same with George Michael, you know, he had released Older before officially coming out, but you can't listen to that album and not realize what was going on there. How important has these artists been in helping you to manage your own anxiety?
It taps into the, you know, once again, the how music is the one constant that I can rely on. That for me, you know, it's my drug. I'll be honest. You know, I'm anti-drugs in terms of prescription drugs. So I'll be, you know, be quite clear on this. I even hate taking Panadol, you know, for a headache. You know, I'd rather have a cup of chamomile tea, or, you know, put some lavender drops on my pillow, or once again, put music on. So music is my drug. It's proven, and because I've had that passion and that love for it my whole life, I don't need anything else other than that, pretty much, you know, to help get me through. So yeah, regardless of the artist, regardless of, I suppose, the era, whether it's, you know, in the 70s growing up listening to rock music, or whether now, you know, I listen to what I like playing at my gigs, or, you know, I love classical music, I love rock music, you know, it's not all about dance music. I think, you know, music just, it evokes so much emotion, you know, and when that can be sad, it can be happy, it can be uplifting. Yeah, it's mood altering, you know, and that's a scientific fact, you know, so I'm not sitting here saying because I love music and I'm a DJ. You know, it's proven. You know, they've tried and tested it. So I think for me, that's why I love sharing my music, because I know I can create that same mood altering. You know, at one of my gigs, I can for 2 hours make people feel great. You know, they go home and say, what an amazing gig. And they go, oh, you're an amazing DJ. I'm like, no, it's not about me. It's about just playing some music that I know you're going to like, that's going to make you feel good, dance and have a great night. You know, so for the next 2 hours, you can just switch off and forget the troubles in the world, or, you know, what's going on in your small world. And that's my job done. You know, that's what gets me off on that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's that release on the dance floor, just allow you to put aside those issues for a moment and just enjoy being present in the moment as well, which is a fantastic skill to have, especially when you do suffer from something like anxiety, because it's so future-focused, where you're expecting things to turn out so badly. To be able to just be present in the moment and to just breathe and to know that in this moment you're okay is a great gift. What, speaking of techniques there to deal with anxiety, what kind of things do you do when you do feel anxiety coming on to help move it aside?
Music again. For me, walking. I do a lot of walking. Not so much sort of gym work that I used to. I suppose as I've gotten a bit older, I find that, you know, you need to adjust what sort of form of exercise, you know, works for you best. You know, 20 years of fitness and experience managing gyms, you know, I've got all those, you know, skills and, you know, the know-how of what to do. I used to work out, you know, 2 or 3 times a week, and that for me doesn't fit now. So, and I'm not saying because I'm not not exercising at the gym that that's, no, some people might say, well, you're not exercising the way you used to, therefore that might be impacting on why you have some anxiety and depression. Yes and no. I mean, obviously exercise is a good endorphin release, but for me, it's walking, it's a bit of, you know, fresh air, a bit of sunshine. So just the basic things. Those things may not work for other people, but I found what works for me, you know, through trial and error. Staying inside is the worst thing I can do. Staying in bed, which does happen. You know, there are days when I have those days where I don't want to get out of bed. You know, I don't want to talk to anyone. I don't want to leave the house. You know, I don't want to eat. I just want to curl up and, you know, and cry myself to sleep. But I know that's not going to help. So sometimes I just have to go, if it means I'm in bed half the day, and then I go, you know what? I've just got to get up. I've got to get up, have a shower. I'm going to go to the house. I've got to move. You know, and I think movement and just, yeah, some sunlight, a bit of fresh air, you know, and just to breathe, you know, those things are, you know, they're the simple things, but I'd much prefer to do that than go and see my doctor and say, you know, I need some prescription drugs. I know many people are on those for their own reasons. I just personally, they wouldn't work for me, and I just don't want to become addicted to a prescription drug when I can do things my own way, a lot simpler, and it's free as well. You know, so I'm looking at the short and the long term benefits to my health and my physicality as well. I don't know. I don't know a lot about prescription drugs or antidepressants, but I just don't think they're for me. You know, that's my choice. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you've been experiencing anxiety and depression for the last 4 years. Do you find that it's becoming easier for you to manage now, or do you feel that it's coming up with its own new challenges as it continues?
Yeah, it does, because obviously in the last few years, different things have come up recently, you know, a relationship breakup, which has been challenging. to say the least, but it's also been very rewarding, if that makes sense. It probably doesn't, but without going into too much detail, I suppose I thank my ex-partner for going through those issues and those challenges that I faced with him, because it's actually helped me get through some of my own anxiety and depression, which at the same time was being caused by that as well. I don't know, breakups are never easy, but you know, you have to sort of go, okay, I've got to get through this. As you were saying, I think earlier, is going through the situation, not around it, not ignoring it, you know, not dodging it. You've just got to, okay, this is going to hurt. This might be hard. You know, it's painful, all those sort of negative emotions, but you just don't know until you do it, you know, and you've just got to get through it. I suppose the easiest way is to try. And if, you know, if it doesn't work, then to try something else. So, it's an evolving, or illness, if we want to call it, or condition. I never know when it's going to hit me. That's the thing. I don't even know the triggers. You know, if someone says, so what triggers you? I said, well, sometimes worrying about a situation can, but then it can just come out of the blue. Yeah. And that's when I find it difficult, because people don't understand it unless they're going through it. So I think just talking about it once again, you know, by opening up with my story and sharing those experiences and actually asking other people, so what triggers you and how do you cope with it and how does it feel for you and what works for you and what doesn't. So then I might think, oh, you know what? I might try that, because that hasn't necessarily worked for me, but I'll give it a go and just see how that works. You know what I mean? Yeah.
How do you know that an attack is coming on?
I don't. I said, you know, I can wake up and within minutes it can be there, or it can come on later in the day. It's generally, though, if there's something I'm worrying about,
yep.
Which generally triggers the sort of... It's like someone asked me the day, how does it feel? I said...
I guess that's what I was coming to, is, you know, what does it feel like for those that... If you were to try to explain to someone who doesn't experience it what it feels like and what's... it's like to go through, how would you describe it?
For me, and I'm sure it's different for everyone, but for me, you know, when you get butterflies, and sometimes butterflies are good, you know, it's that, I get butterflies, okay, before every single gig. I always do. I think it's that nervous sort of before a performance sort of thing. But this is the same feeling, but I get waves of almost the butterflies in a wave, like sweat. It's really hard to explain. It's a tricky question, but yeah, it's like, and it just, and the more I said, like I said before, the more I think about it, the feeling, I can feel it come on even stronger. It's like a drug, yeah. Like a rush. Sometimes it's stronger than other days, and I just try to go, no, don't worry about it. But then the more you tell yourself not to worry about it, and I see you've got little people in the head going, no, you'll be right. So you've got, you know, I'm trying to sort of tap into my own mental side of challenging, how do I deal with this? But sometimes you can't. Sometimes you've just let it go. And other times, if you try and work through it, it's tricky. Yeah, there's no solution. There's no key to the, if I could go, okay, I know what I'm going to do today to solve this, but I can't, you know, because the waves can come quicker. They can last longer. They can go, you know, it's uncontrollable. And that's the challenge, I think.
Is it something that you feel more in the body? Is it something in your mind where you're seeing pictures, or are you telling yourself something? Is it a combination of these things?
It's a bit of everything. Yeah. You know, the feeling is the physicality of the, like I said, the butterflies, the sweats, the shakes, even the uncontrollable urge, you know, to cry. I find I get angry with myself as well. I'm frustrated that, you know, I'm feeling this way. I know I shouldn't be. So there's a mixture of different feelings all going on at once, and to try and, you know, control those and then say to yourself, yeah, you're okay, when you know you are, but then to then try and get on with your day and do stuff. It's also impacted on my, you know, ability to keep certain social commitments. I think in all the years I've been DJing, I've only once, or think twice, turned down a gig because of my anxiety. I said, look, you know, I've got a stomach bug or something, you know, and that scared me, because it wasn't so much the fact that I had to go out and be in front of people. Once I was, I'm fine, but it's just that whole getting from the house to the gig, or getting from home to that social engagement, or that lunch. Once I'm there, it's fine. It's just that whole, no, I can't do this. It almost physically stops you from leaving the house. And so that I find... is not who I'm about. You know, I'm a social person, but, you know, not being able to, you know, keep to a commitment or something. Yeah. And when someone really doesn't understand that, you know, when I say I'm actually sick, I'm not, because I don't like to lie that, you know, I don't have a stomach bug, but I'm actually, you know, quite ill with anxiety, depression. But I used to be worried about telling that to people, but now I'm not. You know, I'll just say, look, I'm having a bad day. And if you understand what I'm going through, then I'm really sorry. I just can't make today. You know, you just have to make another time, you know?
I think it's because, you know, as a society, we, you know, stomach bug, oh, stay home and rest. But when we're talking about something that is within our heads, you know, people kind of think, well, just deal with it. Just, you know, stop thinking that way and come on in and do it. They don't place the same value on mental health as we do on even a stomach bug or the flu or a cold. It's quite remarkable in that way. So I think what you're doing to be able to go out there and to promote discussion and education around this is so critical and vital and important, especially to our community. In your discussions with, you know, friends out there, what kind of things do you see coming up as things that people are getting anxious or depressed about?
So for me, it's two things I think which are very important for me personally, and also I think just in chatting with other people. There's addictions in life and there's connections. So connections, I mean, talking about, you know, a close friend, a partner, loving partner, and even family. And without some of those in your life, addictions, and I'm talking anything from, you know, drugs, alcohol, shopping, porn, gambling, social media. At certain times in my life, I have turned to, apart from gambling, pretty much all of those addictions at some point. I'm still in control, but I feel sometimes they replace the need, or when we don't have a quality connection. Mm-hmm. And it's not a bad thing. Some of those addictions aren't good for, you know, mental health and also for your physical health. I get that, but they replace something that you don't have. And I think that's very important that, you know, we need a good, strong network of connections, whether that's, you know, people you know on the gay scene, whether it's, you know, a partner, whether it's a good couple of close friends, whether it's your family, whether it's some professional help as well. Because without that connection, without that support mechanism, I don't think most people can get through, you know, doing it on their own. I think it's very important, and it has been for me. You know, I've got one close, true friend who I've known for nearly 30 years, and we see each other once a week. She's terminally ill, but we see each other once a week, and to get her mind off all her own dramas and all her own issues in her life, I quite often talk about mine. She's there for me no matter what, and vice versa. So that for me, I know, and like I saw her last night, I know I can go to see her and spend a few hours with her, have maybe a glass of wine or two, you know, have a couple of cigarettes, have a nice meal, watch a movie, have a good laugh. It helps me because I know I've got that connection. She's got my back. Going through a relationship breakup recently, you know, that impacts on that connection. You know, when I haven't been in a relationship, I have fallen into those addictions. You know, when I haven't been financial, I've fallen into those addictions. So even though I know they're not good for me at the time, sometimes it's that reckless Magnus going, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to run off the rails. I'm going to have some fun. I'm not going to hurt anyone. I'm not going to disrespect anyone. Sometimes it's going to be stuff that I'm doing on my own, but I need to do that in a way. I know that sounds almost hypocritical, but I need to do that to help me get through this, even though it's not good for my mental health at the time. But then I know once I get through it, I'm back on track. And you know what? I really didn't need to do that, but I did in a way. And just chatting with a lot of other people that have gone through a breakup or, you know, a similar, I suppose, trauma in their life where they haven't had a quality connection, they do the same thing. So it's a similar experience, I suppose, different reasons, but the same as well.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. There's been research done only in the past few years where they used the Vietnam War as an example, where the US government were giving their troops heroin to get through the day. And at the end of the war, when they sent all the troops back, something like 95% of them were like they never had heroin in their life. They went back to loving families, loving homes, and life continued on. That 5% that went back, they found the common link between them was that they had nothing to go back to, and they ended up forming addiction with heroin. And I think the important thing to realize is that it is about quality, real connections. But the question I would ask people is, what if you don't actually like yourself? What if you don't have a quality connection with yourself? It then becomes very hard to have a quality connection with someone else because you're not offering who you really are. And one of the things I've noticed with working with people with addiction is this amazing inability to give themselves some self-compassion or self-acceptance. And it's quite remarkable. You know, I'll ask them a question and there'll be this really hard black and white thinking about what they should or should not do. And they treat themselves and judge themselves so much harsher than what they would treat anyone else. And it's quite remarkable. In some ways, I feel part of the answer to treating addiction is to teach people how to actually like yourself as a starting point. I mean, I can see you kind of nodding there as I'm talking about that. What do you feel about that statement resonates with you?
It's very true. You know, I'm very much a people person, so therefore I give through my music, through my friendships, through my relationships, through everything I do in life, through my work, you know, whether, like I said, in the fitness industry, I'm helping change someone's life for the better, you know, by signing them up for a gym membership. So I usually and always have, I still don't know why, I'm sort of beginning to identify those triggers and those reasons why I'm the sort of person I am and why I put myself second to everyone else. And what you're saying is, yeah, it's very hard to love yourself. You know, I look in the mirror and I go, you know what? I'm pretty damn hot for a 46-year-old. And I am quite comfortable with how I look and how I feel. But yeah, for others, and it's a cliche, if you can't love yourself, you know, how are you going to love anybody else? And I think it's very hard sometimes for people, including myself. I've had those times where, yeah, my self-esteem is low. My self-confidence is low. So yeah, I've got to sometimes be a bit selfish and go, you know what? It's not about you anymore. It is about me. You know, this is about me loving myself, giving back to me, because as you said, no one else can do it. You know, you've got to be your own lover, if that makes sense, before you can give that out freely to someone else without it being a detriment to you or without it impacting on your own self-esteem, self-confidence. So yeah, that's something I suppose you just learn over the years to sort of, you know, to develop the skills to go, you know what? Sorry, it's a bit time for me. And a lot of people don't get that. They're like, oh, what about me? It's like, well, no, you need to also do that for you. We all do. You know, I think the key to anything is looking within yourself, identifying that that's where you need to start. You know, not the person next to you, not your partner, not your friends, not your family. You need to look at yourself.
Mm. And that's the, like, I mean, I think everyone out there has their flaws and vulnerabilities and insecurities. You know, while you're sitting there saying you've always been confident in how you look, my weakness is that I've never been confident in how I look, but I've been confident in so many other areas of my life. Yet within the gay community especially, your looks is a gay currency in some ways. You know, if you go to any kind of circuit-based party, if you don't have a six-pack, you're pretty much invisible. You don't exist. And so it's interesting how we can allow our own vulnerabilities to give us the excuse to kind of push ourselves back and to allow others to take that place. And we end up doing this people-pleasing behavior in order to try to fit in or to become part of the gang, part of the tribe.
Yeah. And that's something, I suppose, in the gay community, you know, we go to the gym, you know, we like to, you know, look good. But I think sometimes, look, even that, once again, is another form of addiction. Like, is it really helping that person love themselves? You know, yeah, okay. Physically, you look amazing. You know, you've got the hottest body, the six-pack, great. You know, you're proud of what you look like. But is that actually really helping your self-worth and your self-confidence inside? Is, you know, it's just a shell. It's just your body. You know, don't get me wrong. But I think having that isn't the answer. You know, it's actually, I think, also creating, as you said, you know, a bit more segregation in the community. You know, if you don't fit that look, then you're not almost accepted. I mean, it's hard enough coming out for some people being gay. Therefore, you know, to be ostracized, not ostracized, but yeah, being made feel uncomfortable at a party because they don't have a body like that and they don't want to take their shirt off. You know, I think we're all equal, you know, no matter the label, gay or straight. But that doesn't help, you know, and there's so much, I think, also pressure in advertising and in society in general to conform, to look like that, to be almost a fake image of what you are. I I've got 20 years, as I said, fitness industry experience. I just don't think it's the answer. You know, I think it's great that you're keeping fit, but it's creating these other issues, I think, which is adding to, you know, depression, anxiety, not fitting in, you know, self-worth, all those things, I think.
I think that's all we have time for today. But Magnus, I really appreciate your time coming in and chatting with us and being so open to talking about your experiences with anxiety and depression. Where can people catch you?
Oh, everywhere and anywhere. Obviously, look, every Sunday down at the Railway Hotel in Windsor, we call it Shag. It's a bit cheeky. It's a bit, you know, 70s porn. But, yeah, look, come down. There's always a sunny day, and we've got always fabulous weather. Great crowd, great location, happy hour prices. I play at Circuit once a month on Saturday nights. But, yeah, I pretty much play everywhere and anywhere. So, yeah, check out my Facebook page, DJ Magnus. Yeah, you never know where I'll pop up next.
Is there a podcast as well?
There's plenty of podcasts, yeah. So my DJ page, there's links to Podomatic, and also you can subscribe through iTunes. So every time there's a new mix, it'll pop up and you can download that for free.
Excellent. Thanks again. And we look forward to everyone catching up with us at the next podcast in a fortnight's time. Until then, take care.